This is Ozarks at Large for the 23rd day of March 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead on Ozarks, a conversation with Charles Banks Wilson, an Arkansas native and artist who created four of the murals hanging inside the Oklahoma Capitol. And the City of Johnson announces a date for the Johnson Switch Festival Day, which marks the 50th anniversary of the town's incorporation. Those stories are coming up later, but first...
Yesterday, the presidents and chancellors of 16 public universities, colleges, and university systems in Arkansas jointly announced a 16-point pledge. The Higher Education Compact calls for doubling the number of degrees awarded by the schools by the year 2025. Other points in the announcement include transparent decision-making, prudent fiscal management, and efforts to keep tuition as low as possible without sacrificing quality. Also at yesterday's announcement in the State Capitol Rotunda was Shane Broadway, Interim Director of the Department of Higher Education in Arkansas. And Shane Broadway joins me on the phone from Little Rock. Welcome to Ozarks at Large.
I'm honored to be a part of the program.
Well, thank you. Let me ask about the origin of this compact. Was this something that the colleges and universities put together?
It is. It really grew out of the governor's call, Governor Beebe's call in the State of the State address, the challenge to all of us to double the amount of degrees by the year 2025. And it grew out of discussions that we had, myself with ADHE, and conversations with presidents and chancellors about talking about the significance of that issue and a renewed sense of urgency, I think, on all of our parts in higher education to make a commitment to that goal and a number of other tenets that go in to help producing that goal. And so we met, they met several times. I met with them one time in terms of talking about a number of those issues that we knew we could all find common ground on in terms of a collaborative effort. Dr. Dave Gerhart, Chancellor at the University of Arkansas, was assigned the task to kind of lead the effort in terms of writing the document itself. And so he spent a great deal of time. We all looked through several drafts of the compact that was announced yesterday. And obviously yesterday was a good day because it was spring break week. And so many of the presidents and chancellors could get away from campus because of spring break. So that was a lot of the timing issue, but there was a lot of collaborative effort amongst the presidents and chancellors, great discussion, and really talking about how we at the state level at ADHE can work together with the chancellors and presidents and the colleges and universities to achieve these goals that have been laid out.
I know that there can be common ground with 16 schools and colleges and the university systems. I wonder, in negotiations to bring 16 of anything together, who are sometimes competing for, you know, students' attention, potential
right.
students' attention. You said you met with them once. Any idea what the negotiations or the conversations were like among the presidents and chancellors?
Well, it was very cordial. I mean, it was a great discussion that needed to take place about realizing the role that higher education institutions play in the future of Arkansas's economy. When it comes to economic development, comes to creating jobs, creating economic opportunities for Arkansas families. And it really centered around that discussion and how we can best place higher education at the table with the governor and the legislature as they're discussing a whole set of priorities. You know, I've sat in a legislator's seat. I know the issues they're faced with a finite amount of resources, the decisions that they have to make regarding budgetary decisions. And so we want to make sure that higher education has its place at that table in those discussions. We know these are tough economic times, but I think a renewed sense by the colleges and universities emphasizing their role, how they can make that role better, how they can improve the state's economy, which in turn produces more general revenue for legislators and the governor to be able to make budgetary decisions. So it was a very frank, very good discussion about what we need to be doing really together, you know, as a state, if we're going to move it forward. Of course, all the different campuses have different areas of expertise, different missions and scopes and different students that they serve, and all of that was brought out onto the table of how we best try to serve those different constituencies. So, but it was a great discussion, and kind of like you said, anytime you can get that number of campuses to agree on one thing is a great thing. It's not necessarily something that's always occurred in the past.
To double the number of degrees awarded by these schools in 14 years, it doesn't just happen on the campuses of these schools. One of the pledges is to work with K through 12 schools to reduce the need for student remediation in post-secondary education. This is a long-ranging plan.
It is. It is, and it has to be. We didn't really get in this situation overnight, although if you really look at it historically over the last 20 years, we've come a long way. We started at a very low level, though, in terms of the number of people in Arkansas that have a degree, and we're still relatively low. But if you look at it comparatively where we've come from, we've made significant progress, but we all know we have a long way to go, and it's not going to happen overnight. But it does require partnerships, and that's what we've tried to do in this session with our legislative package, the governor's legislative package, focused on remediation, one you just mentioned. We have a bill that's going through the process right now where I worked with the Department of Education and legislators to develop ways in which we can utilize resources at the K through 12 level to try to address remediation before those students get to the college campus. Because a lot of times when the remediation report comes out, it shows how many students had to be remediated when they got to college. And a lot of times that blame, for whatever reason, sometimes tends to fall towards the colleges. Well, they're just taking the students that were sent to them through the K through 12 system. So we have to work backwards with the K through 12 process and the system that they have. The significant gains that they've made, we're starting to see some of those results, but we still have a lot of things we can do collaboratively with them, and that's one of the bills that's going through the process right now. Another one is working with the Department of Career Education. I have a meeting with them today talking about how we can utilize the services that they have, especially adult education, to assist us in the remediation, especially of adults. Kyle, if we're going to really move the needle to get to this goal, it's not going to just occur with high school students graduating and going to college. Over half of Arkansans have some kind of college credit, but no degree. And so one of the keys is bringing those adults back into college and getting them some sort of credential, whether it's a certificate or an associate's degree or a degree. Either of those, anything beyond a high school diploma, is going to allow the Arkansas Economic Development Commission to better go out and recruit industry and jobs to our community. It's going to help us to grow our own businesses. It's going to help us to retain jobs. The statistics are just there. The more highly educated populace you have, the better you're going to be able to recruit jobs and retain jobs in your state. And so it has to happen not only at the K-12 level, but also with adults and trying to bring them back into the higher education process and getting them something beyond just a high school diploma.
Shane Broadway is the interim director of the Arkansas Department of Higher Education. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure, Kyle. Anytime. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Tomorrow morning, a committee of the Arkansas Legislature will consider a bill to allow state public education money to follow severely disabled children who cannot function in public school settings into alternative education settings. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Children stricken with cerebral palsy, autism, seizure disorders, and other physical and neurological impairment will be in the audience along with their parents tomorrow morning when the Arkansas House Education Committee members meet to discuss the merits of the Extension Education Program for Certain Exceptional Students Act. Sponsor, Arkansas State Representative Deborah Hobbs, a Republican representing District 96 in Rogers, says this bill especially targets children with autism spectrum disorder, or ASD.
This bill would allow parents to set up an account with the Department of Education that would have the same amount of money that the school would typically get for educating that child. And we're talking just the per student funding according to the state formula, not, you know, all the property taxes and so forth that that the school gets in addition to that state funding. The account would be set up. There would be an IEP team to determine who could best help this child in the education process. It might be a private teacher, it might be a behavioral therapist or a counselor, an OT, just whatever the IEP team decides or determines that would best meet the needs of the student.
The department would then have 30 days to reject or accept the application. The extension program, advocates say, would not cost the taxpayers anything because it's covered by base educational foundation money allocated to every student in Arkansas, plus alternative learning funding.
And again, since we're talking about per student funding, you know, it's going to cost the same state the same amount whether they give it to the school or they have it in an account to provide for the needs of the student.
One in every 110 children are diagnosed with some form of autism. According to the Centers for Disease Control, those on the far end of the spectrum may not respond when called, tend to avoid eye contact, and cannot interpret simple social cues. Many children with ASD have phobias, may obsessively rock or twirl, or worst case, engage in self-abusive behavior. And vivid lights and loud noises like school bells or buzzers can set them off.
I talked with a special ed teacher last week who noted that they had a child in their classroom who would have, I'm going to call it meltdowns, for lack of a better terminology at this point, but they would have like a, you know, a screaming fit because of you know, of the condition that they have. And so they would have to take the other kids out of the classroom while this child was calmed down. So it not only affects those individual students, but it also affects the other students in the classroom.
But the Arkansas Department of Education does not support a special education extension program. Spokesperson Seth Blomley.
No, we are opposed to it. We can certainly identify and sympathize and, you know, want to help the kids. But this bill essentially would set up what amounts to a voucher program that would funnel state money to homesteading education potentially, where then there'd be no regulation of the providers who the parents would pick to do these treatments. For the most part, these kids really need to be in school, and there's plenty of treatment available in the public schools. There'd be additional administrative costs for the state to set this program up, potential for lawsuits, and the annual cost we've projected is $84 million.
The State Education Department estimates of the $84.5 million required to operate a special education extension program, $560,000 would be administrative, $24.2 million would go toward 4,000 ASD students, $13.6 million for 1,300 with cerebral palsy, $46 million for 4,600 students with seizure disorders. That accounts for both the currently enrolled and unenrolled. And that's money that does not need to be spent on a program that is already in place, Seth Blomley says.
A lot of these students can take advantage of programs already in the public schools. We have qualified therapists in the public schools who can help these kids out. And in most cases, a lot of these kids would be better served in the public schools. And they will be regulated a lot stronger in the public schools than under this bill the therapists would be.
According to the U.S. Department of Education, as of 2009, 330,000 children with ASD were enrolled in public school nationwide, but more than 100,000 were not. In the winter of 2009, then-Representative Mark Martin, now Arkansas Secretary of State, introduced a same measure. It twice failed in the House Education Committee and was recommended for study by the Joint Interim Committee on Education, which took place last fall. The measure was refiled this session in late February by Deborah Hobbs. Mark Moore authored the original bill. He's uncle of two homeschooled children with autism. He says the State Education Department's estimated cost of operating an extension program has been purposely inflated. He says if certain children with extreme special needs are not given special opportunities, they will end up a burden to society.
It's going to be the difference between whether or not they become functioning members of society or spend the rest of their lives in an institution, or not even an institution, but is, you know, locked up.
The Extension Education Program for Certain Exceptional Students Act will be considered by the House Education Committee at the State Capitol, Room 138, beginning at 10 a.m. on Thursday. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Earlier this month, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe signed into law a bill requiring insurance companies to cover autism diagnosis and treatment. Ahead on Ozarks at Large, a visit with Charles Banks Wilson, the iconic portrait artist, interviewed by Ozarks at Large's Zan Jarvis. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large.
History of art in the 20th century is written, Charles Banks Wilson's work will have a special place. His paintings, bronzes, and lithographs of Native Americans in ceremony and in everyday life is unsurpassed. He recorded life in the mines and on the farm as well. His works are in galleries and museums nationwide. But he's very much a 21st century artist too. A series of new oil sketches and limited editions of his lithographs are currently at Hartwood Gallery in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Zan Jarvis recently visited Wilson in his Fayetteville home studio and talked to him about how he continues to work as an artist as he moves through the 10th decade of his life.
When you see the books about Charles Banks Wilson's art, the documentary of his life work, the lively murals in the Oklahoma Capitol, and the list of his private and gallery collectors, you might think that here's a man who would be satisfied and content to rest on his laurels. But at 93, Wilson isn't so much concerned about what he'll leave behind as about what's on the drawing board to do next.
Every one that I do, I say this is the last one I'm going to do. And I think I have done 14 last ones. But I'm getting ready to do another one.
Drawing one picture after another has been Wilson's whole life. He can remember being just a tiny boy standing under the kitchen table looking up to draw on the bottom of the tabletop. He was just a boy when he did his most famous Will Rogers portrait just before the show at the Miami Theater. After an education at the Art Institute of Chicago and a career as a book and magazine illustrator in New York City, Wilson came home and kept on making pictures.
I think I'm trying to maybe artistically record my time. I think that maybe be it, because I don't think I've ever just taken a theme and stayed with that. Maybe I was thinking a little bit more of my experience. My experience was with the Indians.
At a time when mainstream America had only Indian stereotypes from the movies put before them, Wilson offered up another view. In paintings and lithographs, he recorded the lives of the native people he knew and saw every day. He showed them carrying forward their traditions while incorporating the dominant culture. He detailed their individuality, their dignity, and their humanity in work after work. To do this, he didn't employ research or ask permission. He simply drew what he saw.
I camped with the Indians, and so I was familiar with the camps more than I was the powwow. The kids, and these fellas always had stories to tell. So that's something I saw many, many times.
Though many people know Wilson best for his Indian paintings, his body of work encompasses much more. He detailed life in the mines in eastern Oklahoma and recorded rural scenes of all kinds. His 1970s mural for the Oklahoma State Capitol condenses the entire history of the state into four huge panels installed in the dome of the building.
I think probably what's the best thing I've ever done, I think the murals around the Capitol.
That may be an easy call for him, but it's much harder for an aficionado, which I must confess myself to be, to choose a favorite. Flip through a book of his work and each image seems more interesting than the last. And he continues to confuse things further by adding to the body of his work from his Fayetteville home studio.
Lately I've been doing some small things, and this is one right here that I'm going to do as a painting.
On the drawing board now is a humorous take on the settling of the West from the Indian's point of view.
The train's coming in, and there's an Indian and his dog. We're looking up at the train, first train into Miami, Oklahoma. And I had it down below the Indian, and it says, well, there goes the neighborhood.
On his easel now is an oil sketch of Indian boys galloping their horses bareback and laughing.
I call it a happy time, because they always think of Indians never smiling and doing nothing but fighting and whatever. So I wanted to do a painting of them coming back, enjoying the trip.
Other paintings in his new series of oil sketches spotlight the beauty of horses. Wilson says he's always had a sort of love affair with the animals.
The horse has a certain design that I am intrigued with, and I think that motivates more, encourages me more to do the horse as a painting than would be anything else.
Wilson almost photographically reproduces the scenes he's witnessed, yet much of his career happened in a time when abstract painting captured center stage in the art world. I asked him if he ever felt drawn to paint abstract canvases. To my surprise, he said abstraction is part of every one of his paintings. He considers each work first as an organization of lines, shapes, and colors.
The abstract, of course, limits it to the design. And quite often the subject matter inspires me to do the good design. Yeah, so I believe there's no painting that I've done that is totally motivated by the subject matter, unless that subject matter motivates and inspires me to do design.
One secret to his long career is that he's always pleased the most important person looking at the result. And while you and I might call them works of art, Wilson sees his output as something else entirely.
I'd say 99% of the paintings that I've done were to please me. And I'm not really that concerned about whether somebody else likes it or not. I mean, I'm, of course, yeah, I guess my ego would want you to like what I did. But the reason I did it was because I thought, this will be fun. And I'm a person who thinks of art as fun.
Wilson agrees that it's fair to say that none of his paintings are really finished until he is. In his collection are dozens of wonderful works that he looks at daily. Like most artists, he can always see where improvements can be made.
As I sat today and looked at that painting over there, the tree. I was just thinking the background's competing with the tree too much, and I probably will paint it lighter.
When I asked Wilson what he'd like his legacy to be, it seemed to be a topic he'd given little thought to. He said he tried to accurately depict the times of his life and show the things he values most. Despite a career rich in accolades and thick with commissions from the rich and famous, Wilson doesn't seem certain the world gets what he was trying to do.
If I wanted to be remembered, I kind of wish that people would appreciate what I've done more than they do now.
Why do you feel that they don't now?
I don't know. I don't know that it's... The now is particularly appropriate, I think. I just think that people perhaps wouldn't understand. Maybe understand is a better word than appreciate and all that. Understand. Because I am essentially trying to say something. And you probably hope that people will understand what you're trying to say.
Beauty lives in the most ordinary things. For me, that's the compelling truth of his work. As I went out the door, I spotted a photograph. It shows a young Charles Banks Wilson standing between Henry Moore and Pablo Picasso. That seems like fitting company for him. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zan Jarvis.
You can find Wilson's latest paintings and limited edition lithographs at Heartwood Gallery in Fayetteville. You can go online to heartwoodgallery.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
George Friedrich Handel's oratorio Messiah had its premiere in London on this date in 1743. An internationally known German composer and keyboard virtuoso, Handel has written more than 40 Italian operas, chamber music, church music, oratorios, and instrumental music. By the age of 12, Handel had already mastered several instruments. He was the assistant organist at a cathedral and became the main organist at the age of 17. Handel studied law for a year at a university before dropping out to study music and orchestration in Hamburg. Once there, Handel became a violinist in a theater orchestra. During this time, he taught himself how to write opera. He composed his first opera in 1704. After achieving success in writing three more operas, he moved on to Italy in an attempt to learn more about opera composition. In 1709, he finished his sixth opera in Venice. A year later, he moved to London. The first opera he composed while in London was Rinaldo, in which he achieved great success. The Duke of Chandos, after seeing the opera, gave Handel permission to compose an oratorio titled Esther and the 11 Chandos, Anthems for Choir and String Orchestra. It was this accomplishment that won him the approval of the king and permission to open the Royal Academy of Music. The academy collapsed in 1728. Handel attempted to open another company, but that too collapsed in the 1730s. The musician suffered a stroke in 1737 and was forced to retire while recovering. After recovering from his stroke, Handel resumed composing. In 1741, he composed his last opera. His most memorable work, Messiah, was also composed at this time. It was first performed in Dublin and earned immediate success. When the King of England saw the performance and stood at the end, everyone else also stood. This has become a tradition at a Messiah performance that everyone stands at the end for the Hallelujah chorus. The German prisoner of war camp in Lake Village, Arkansas, closed on this date in 1946. At its height, the camp housed more than 300 German enlisted men, most of whom were considered Nazi sympathizers. Lake Village is located in the extreme southeastern part of the state. While Lake Village is the smallest incorporated town by square miles in Chico County, it has served as the county seat since 1857. The hub of commercial activity for the county, Lake Village prides itself on its rich agricultural background. Wayne Gretzky of the Los Angeles Kings broke Gordie Howe's National Hockey League career record with his 802nd goal on this date in 1994. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's Wednesday, March 23rd, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
I'm going to say the words Kyle hates. Stop listening to us and go to the Jones Center in Springdale. Go right now. It's Adventure Day as part of their spring break free camp. And there's a performance by Trout Fishing in America at 2 o'clock.
Now, there's limited seating.
There is, and that's why you need to go right now.
Right.
And get your ticket. Hopefully they're not all gone by now.
We warned you yesterday.
We probably should have warned him more, but go now, because they also have the Prince and Princess Tea Party and visits by local mascots, including Strike.
From Northwest Arkansas Naturals.
Or Sasquatch, as some of us call him.
Right.
Also, there is a spring break movie at the Fayetteville Public Library at 2. How to Train Your Dragon.
I have not seen that, but it got such great reviews.
Such a cute movie.
That's what I've heard.
Also a spring break movie at the Springdale Public Library at 2, open season 3.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, they're funny. It's okay. A cartoon. It's okay. A lot of fun. And the spring break movie for teens at 2 o'clock at the Rogers Public Library, Napoleon Dynamite. So go out and have fun.
Gets better every time you see it, I think. Becca Bacon Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Guitar prodigy Julian Lage melds blues, classical, folk, and jazz influences to craft his unique sound. The young artist emerged on the music scene 13 years ago. In 2009, at the age of 21, Lage released the album Sounding Point, which received a Grammy nomination for Best Contemporary Jazz Album. On Saturday night, the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville will present two performances by the Julian Lage Group. Lage's second album, titled Gladwell, is scheduled to be released next month. Last week, Robert Ginsberg, host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, spoke to Lage about his new record.
From what I've read, it sounds as if you are encouraging listeners to this music to explore it almost as if they were exploring geography or an unfamiliar town or a village.
And yeah.
And there's an architectural element to how it's constructed. I wonder, what were your desires in taking this approach? And maybe you can clarify that a little.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I have a group, and we set out to make a record about, I don't know, maybe last summer was kind of when we began the process. And we tried on a lot of different hats. You know, we thought about it, like, well, let's just get the best songs we've been doing over the last 2 years of touring and record those. And then we even would make demos of this music. And it was all really good, but it was lacking this kind of creative spark that I think my band really enjoys a lot. In live performance, a lot of times we'll take tunes that we've, you know, been playing a lot, and like most jazz musicians, improvise with them, but change the form constantly. We kind of let ourselves get get kind of stuck in a way. You know, we find an element or four bars that we think is really beautiful, and we'll just stay there and let it evolve, and maybe a new song comes out. So there's this kind of rapport that the band has that I felt was missing when we just did, you know, good song after good song. I mean, good by our standards, where we say, yeah, that sounds like a, you know, we'll put that on a record. It didn't have that vulnerability and that fearlessness that I think we had experienced live. So this kind of set us off on a bit of a tangent. And the question became, you know, what does 70 minutes of music sound like? Studied this and we played with it, and I think the fundamental thing that kept coming back was that anything that has a storyline or a through line holds up really well. You know, kind of doesn't matter what you do with the note choices always, as much as how clear is your overall intention, where are you going, where's the beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, fundamental musical elements. So from that perspective, we started with this idea of a town called Gladwell. And Gladwell was something that just kind of came to my mind a while, maybe a year or two ago. And it's very esoteric in a certain sense, because I don't know where it comes from, probably a mishmash of different things I've read or heard about or seen in movies. But essentially it's a town that existed a long time ago, well forgotten, no one knows about it. And the idea was, what if you make a record that's basically a sonic blueprint that, you know, we have to tell the listeners that there's this place that was actually really special, but there's no documentation. So we're going to kind of tell you about it. We're going to have a song that describes the journey into the town, you know, including, you know, the person you meet at the front, the gatekeeper. It tells you where people hang out at the bars. It tells you about where people live. It tells you about where people might go to the spiritual center of the town, whether it be religious or otherwise, but kind of a sacred place. So it really represented a barometer, and boy, did it focused our attentions like crazy. And it made the recording process very fun. I mean, it was a very quick record to make, in a sense. But that was deliberate. We went in for 2 days, and we just said, let's just press record and play and experiment. And that's how we recorded it, too. We would do, like, one song and then say, okay, we literally say, now where are we? Okay, I feel like we're kind of near where people live now. Okay, let's play music that sounds like that. And it might have been a song that was predetermined for that location. It might have been free. It didn't matter. We just wanted to kind of tell the story whatever ways we could. We have a band that is a bit eclectic, you know, with cello, saxophone, guitar, bass, and percussion. And the cellist is from a primarily classical background. I'm primarily from a jazz background. Everyone's from different places, and the pursuit for us was, well, what does this band do that's great, that's unique to this band? And that was an interesting question to ask. It's not the same as, what's your wildest musical dream? What do you want to happen? It's kind of like, how do you honor the people that are in your band and their strengths? And amazingly, a storyline was something that wasn't personal. It wasn't about me. It was this auxiliary thing that we could devote our energies to.
It's a reality you all. It's a reality you all created. It sounds like
exactly. I think that's kind of what a band is. I mean, a band is kind of like a group of native people to a certain, you know, area or concept, and they speak a language that's pretty unique, and maybe to a listener, it's not always clear what language they're speaking, but it seems like the group knows what's happening. And I don't know, there's something kind of fascinating about putting that on display.
Well, besides the ensemble work on this CD, you actually accompany yourself. You do some overdubbing solo work. And you know, I'm curious, you kind of talked about the dynamic of playing within the context of these other musicians and their personalities and their energy. I wonder, do you find that you can surprise yourself with your own playing as you might be surprised by a bandmate when you overdub?
That's a great question. You can. It's a different quality of surprise, but it's
like, can you tickle yourself?
Yeah, you can. You can. Oh my God, that was. You either love it or, you know, sometimes you're like, that was a terrible decision. But if that's the case, you know immediately how to rectify it because you know the way you think. You know, and for these pieces you're describing, I had access to this beautiful old Martin from the 20s. This great guitar that I've always loved, and the truth is, I never played it much, as it was for friends. But I said, let me bring it into the studio without having any experience on it and just improvise kind of four songs. I'm going to improvise four songs. And the way I did it was I spent years practicing with timers because I always like chronology and getting used to what music feels like. What does 2 minutes of time feel like? What are the ways that can manifest and so on? So I did just that. I set a timer for 2 minutes, and I would improvise a piece on this new guitar. And what's cool is that the guitar is surprising me, too, because it's not something, I'm familiar with. You know, this note sounds different than my other one, or this D string really resonates well, but the C sharp isn't so great. You know, like all these things are kind of appearing as the tape is rolling. And then without any real break, we would roll the tape again, and I would record another 2 minutes on top of it. And it's that first layer and that immediacy where you're kind of like, you half remember what you just played, but you don't know when things happened. You know, you're kind of like, okay, there should be a this chord coming and there should be that. And so it's great. And then I did that. As soon as the second layer was done, I would immediately do a third layer. And that was really cool because now I'm kind of in third person and I'm looking objectively at these two tracks that are pretty cohesive. And then I get to just comment, you know, and say, oh, I like this, or let me enhance this. Or now I know because I've heard it twice that this chord is where I end. And so we did this four times, and I personally love that experience so much because it does show a personal dialogue, kind of like you're talking to yourself, a little bit crazy, a little bit all over the place. But somehow it's born out of the same creative motivation. And that's the glue that holds together this kind of chaos. And I love it. I really love it.
It also seems like it would be a very interesting exercise in timing and density, yeah, and taste.
That's all exposed. Yeah, yeah. It's especially density, because it is a bit crazy to just play and play and play, you know, on top of yourself. But you can kind of catch these beautiful moments where only you would have known this was coming up. You know, it's very personal. And I originally had intended for everyone in the band to do it, actually. Just kind of like everyone introducing themselves to themselves. And we just, because of time, we never got to.
Well, there will be more time.
There will be more time, yes. Absolutely.
Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, talked with Julian Lage last week. The Julian Lage Group will perform at 8 and again at 10 Saturday night at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. More information about the performance is available at 443-5600 or online at waltonartcenter.org. The city of Johnson is deciding to celebrate a new event. It's called the Johnson Switch Festival. It will be an observation of the city's 50th anniversary of incorporation. The city of Johnson hopes the festival becomes an annual affair. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolker offers this preview.
Earlier this month, Mayor Lonnie Barron of Johnson announced the celebration of Johnson Switch Festival Day on June 11th this year. The day marks the city's 50th anniversary of incorporation. Denny Upton is a detective with the Johnson Police Department and chairman of the Johnson Festival Committee. He says the festival hopes to celebrate history of the town.
The Johnson Switch is actually part of the Frisco Railroad system that came in 50 years ago. So this is just a time and opportunity to sort of celebrate a 50th anniversary.
Denny says the Johnson Switch Festival is based on a similar event that was celebrated a few years ago.
It was just simply setting up some vendors. We had local vendors. We had some folks that came in out of town. And it was just an arts and crafts kind of fair. It was just sort of a small, localized. And this year we're going to expand it to where it's somewhat larger.
This year, the celebration will also include a flea market, live music, and a car and motorcycle show sponsored by Roland Relics Car Club,
which is a new event for us. And we're also hoping to have numerous vendors and local people be offered the opportunity to set up tables here on Main Street in Johnson. And then later in the evening, we're hoping to have a music in the park, which will be again a local event for folks to just be able to sit in our park and enjoy some music and just have a time to relax.
As the chair of the Johnson Festival Committee, Denny Upton hopes the event will add to the long list of Northwest Arkansas festivals, such as Rogers Frisco Festival, Fayetteville's Bike Blues and Barbecue, etc.
Well, we're hoping that this will start as an annual event with the upcoming of the 50th anniversary. We're hoping that we'll be able to continue having this festival day here in Johnson every year, making it an annual event.
The Johnson Switch Festival will be celebrated on June 11th and will take place between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Main Street in Johnson. For more details, contact Denny Upton at 521-3192. For Ozarks at Large, Amiti Agnihotri Madholkar.
So we just heard about plans for Johnson Switch Festival Day, and there are several other towns in our listening area who also host annual festivals. Some examples are Frisco Fest in Rogers, Spring Fest in Fayetteville, and the Grape Festival in Taneytown. Mm-hmm. So for today's trivia question, we are asking about the Apple Blossom Festival. Now, have you heard of this, Kyle?
Well, I have to admit that I saw your question before
Okay.
No, I had not.
So a lot of you listeners probably have not heard of this, and that's okay, because this spring event only lasted from 1923 to 1927. So our question is, during those 5 years, what city hosted the Apple Blossom Festival? Was it A, Rogers, B, Bentonville, or C, Pea Ridge?
And I guessed, right? I did not sneak it.
You did guess,
I was right.
And you were right.
But I used some deduction.
Did you?
I did.
Okay.
And we are playing the person who gets the correct answer and is pulled out of the
box for right now.
Because we don't have a permanent replacement for the wooden chicken yet, will receive
2 movie tickets.
To the Malco Theater of your choice.
Yep.
Okay. So again, the Apple Blossom Festival happened for 5 years in the 20s.
Yep. Was it in A, Rogers, B, Bentonville, or C, Pea Ridge?
You can call 800-522-5223. That's 800-522-5223, 800-522-KUAF. If you give us the correct answer, you'll be eligible to win the 2 movie passes. Good luck.
Before Writer's Almanac, we asked today's trivia question, which was, from 1923 to 1927, what city hosted the Apple Blossom Festival? Was it A, Rogers, B, Bentonville, or C, Pea Ridge? And the answer, Kyle?
I guessed A, Rogers.
And you were right.
And I said that I used deduction.
Yes. How did you use deduction?
I knew that you came up with the question, and you live in Rogers.
Okay. That,
so that's not really logic.
I don't think that helps people very much. But
no.
The idea for the festival came from a local businessman who had attended a peach festival in, of course, Georgia. Mm-hmm. But actually, around the turn of the 20th century, this area had been known as the land of the big red apple. In 1901, Benton County's crop of 2.5 million bushels set a national record for one county. But by 1927, the industry wasn't doing so well. They had been plagued by diseases and late frosts, and the orchards just weren't profitable anymore. The festival also had problems with frequent spring rains and difficulty finding volunteers. The tradition, yes, was partly revived in the mid-30s and early 40s with banquets and orchard tours, but that's about it.
But the Apple Blossom Festival in Rogers was done by 1928.
1927 was the last one. So,
and you mentioned 1901. It was in 1901 that the Arkansas legislature made the apple blossom the official state flower of Arkansas.
Okay.
And it remains that to today.
Today.
By the way, congratulations to Buji Selassie, who won yesterday. She knew that Louise Thaden, Bentonville native, was the only pilot to hold the women's record simultaneously of endurance, speed, and another record.
And another one.
That escapes me.
I was so sure it was Amelia Earhart, and it just wasn't.
No. So here's a hint. If you ever hear a question at this time, and one of the answers is obviously connected to Arkansas, and the others aren't,
It's probably the answer.
That one, yes.
Okay.
So Louise Thaden, who the Bentonville airport is named after. Oh, and we should mention that the town of Lincoln in Washington County still hosts the Arkansas Apple Festival.
Yes, not Apple Blossom.
Right.
But Apple Festival.
Right.
Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Peel Compton Foundation, celebrating its 20th anniversary and supporting the Victorian-aged Peel Mansion and Historic Gardens in Bentonville. Rental accommodations are available for weddings, receptions, corporate events, luncheons, and more. Photos and information available at peelcompton.org. A service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Vaughan.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Another new edition of the program tomorrow
at noon.
Until then, thanks. Have a great Wednesday.